TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Anand Giridharadas testifies before the Dutch Parliament. Why the super rich won't change the world. Giridharadas was amazed when he received an invitation from the Finance Committee of the Dutch Parliament. They wanted to discuss his book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. He had not expected to see conservatives meet with him, but all parties showed up and engaged him for an hour and a half. Giridharadas tweeted on October 17, 2019, "They were something one rarely sees in politics, curious. They had more questions than answers." It was super disorienting for an American. Here are highlights from that astounding meeting. Anand Giridharadas gave a short introduction.
It is an honor to be here in The Hague, the past home of my wife and the future home of President Donald Trump. Thank you to the Finance Committee for inviting me, for hosting me, and party leader Lillian Marijnissen for having me in particular. I'm honored to be invited to testify, but I must confess that your invitation also saddened me. When I learned that this body from time to time invites writers and artists to share their ideas with no agenda beyond your own desire to learn and grow, I realize what a long way we Americans have to go. In my country, a writer has a greater chance of being run over by the presidential golf cart than of being asked to edify Congress. It is a credit to you and to this country. And thanks to you, my Indian-born parents have finally achieved my newfound definition of the American dream, which is moving to the United States in the hope that one day your child will testify before the Dutch Parliament. I was invited here to speak to you about a book that I've written. In English, it's known as Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. In Dutch, it is even more straightforward, Why the Super Rich Won't Change the World. It is, I should tell you, a book focused on the United States, but hopefully with resonances for the situations of others. As a writer, I've always found it's better to speak of the specific reality you know and inhabit, leaving others to figure out what may be true for them also. Some years ago, I began to notice something. Everywhere I looked, the biggest corporations and the wealthiest people were talking like revolutionaries. They spoke of changing the world, making a difference, and fighting inequality. You saw it in the explosion of philanthropy in the United States and around the world, where more money is being given away now than has ever been given away in history. You saw it in the rise of various new tools promoted by the winners of what I call our age of capital. Social enterprise, impact investment funds, green bonds, give one, get one products. Basically everything Bono is involved with. But these do-gooding activities pursued by the winners of American capitalism sat uncomfortably beside a second, grimmer phenomenon. Even as these elites talked and did so much about seeking justice, they were, as a social class, becoming virtual monopolists of progress itself. That same 1% that was so generous was capturing half of all new income in the United States, in large part because its members lobbied for public policies that ensured that outcome. The 0.1% was reported to hold more wealth than the bottom 80% of Americans put together. The 400 richest families were found to pay a lower effective tax rate than those hundreds of times poorer than them. And most Americans were found to be unable to withstand the shock of a $400 emergency expense without tumbling into debt. And as you know, in the United States, we have a lot more of those emergency expenses than you have here because so much less is covered. I began to wonder what the relationship was between this extraordinary elite helping, which is real, and the extraordinary elite hoarding that was equally real. The conventional wisdom, I think, was that the elite helping was well-meaning and was doing everything it could, but that there simply wasn't enough of it. If only we maybe had more billionaires, if only billionaires could figure out how to give their money away more effectively, if only there were more Mark Zuckerbergs. Scary, right? But I began to be curious about an opposite possibility. What if the rampant elite generosity that I saw around me was part of how we maintained the rampant elite hoarding? What if in the plutocracy that America was becoming, the plutocrats, or the plutes, as I like to call them, to save time, had figured out how to do just enough good to cleanse their names and reputations, douse resentment, bend public discourse in favorable directions, and stave off more thoroughgoing reforms that would be good for the society, but bad for them. After all, it was telling that when the change agents of market world, as I call it, put forward their visions, they seldom talked about things like taxes, unions, regulations, laws, and democracy itself. They saw very little role for people like you. They wanted to change the world, but only if the changes in question were win-wins, were good for the plutocrats and for the public. They weren't interested in real change, which in this era, like in so many eras, necessarily involves the loss of power for those who have too much. With these questions in mind, I began my investigation as a reporter 4 years ago. As I have with my other books, I went deep into the world I was trying to understand, to report on it. In this case, the plutocracy. The wine was delicious. I spent time with foundation leaders and corporate types and young people and even a former American president who has become the great best friend of all the world's plutocrats. And what I found, I will distill for you this way. In America today, but not only in America, of course, a great deal of what is marketed as change is in fact a sly, subtle defense of the status quo. It is change paid for, supervised by, and governed by the winners of capitalism, partly in the hope that our system of capitalism itself won't be questioned. In this way, I found making a difference has become the wingman of making a killing. Giving back has become the wingman of excessive taking. Generosity has become the wingman of injustice. And changing the world, that ubiquitous term, has become the wingman of ensuring that the plutocrats' world does not change. In America, but also beyond it, woke capitalism, also known as the new capitalism, conscious capitalism, or doing well by doing good capitalism, has become a smokescreen, distracting us from the manic hypercapitalism that has shredded our opportunity structure and now imperils the earth. Now, hearing me describe the American situation, you may be thinking, thank goodness this is not our problem here in Holland. And to be sure, your social model is more compassionate, your tax structure more progressive. But I want to take this opportunity to be direct with you, given that this is the Finance Committee. Your country has become a shelter from the tax authorities for companies in my country. As your news site, De Correspondent, puts it, the Netherlands is the biggest tax haven in the world for American companies, bigger than the Cayman Islands, bigger than Switzerland, bigger even than Bermuda. But I would like to sharpen that newspaper's observation a little. For what you are really doing when you serve as a kind of Cayman of the North, a classy, respectable, non-island tax haven, no pina coladas. What you're really doing, in a sense, is exporting oligarchy to other countries. I am concerned that the Netherlands is betraying its own long-standing egalitarian traditions by facilitating the spread of plutocracy elsewhere, including in my country. There are children in my country who will not get health care today, because your country gives companies in my country a shield, a safe harbor from taxation. It isn't enough to keep your own society free of plutocratic capture, as perhaps you feel you have. All of our societies must stand together in solidarity with one another and not serve as tools for plutocrats to duck and cheat. My message today may be bracing, but I also come to you with a message of hope and for you of duty. In an age defined by the strivings of capital, the idea of changing the world has been co-opted by those with little interest in actual structural change. And so my book culminates in the following thesis. We must change where we go to change the world. We must return to our democracies. That means you. It is time to stop repeating tired mantras about how government is inept, slow, not up to the task of solving our biggest shared problems. First of all, this is an unfair portrait. Government does a great many unsung things that allow more visible and celebrated things to happen. But if government does often genuinely seem inadequate to the task before it, it is to a great degree because it has been on the receiving end of a strident campaign waged by moneyed interests to defang it, starve it, strip its authority, and tarnish its standing in the public mind. Yet I believe much of the chaos and turbulence in the world today can be explained by the age of capital running out of steam, becoming consumed by its own excesses and contradictions. And I believe that a new age is coming, a period that I hope will one day be called the age of reform, an age in which we act together through collective institutions, such as this one, to turn this era of innovation, which no one would deny we are in, into something we have failed to create thus far, an age of progress, if progress means most people's lives getting better. I believe you in this body, like democratic actors around the world, are the change agents we need at this hour. And so I thank you for inviting me. I would be happy to think aloud with you about how to seize the promise of this moment and how to take back the changing of the world. Thank you very much.
Dan moet ik officieel zeggen dat u geen goedkeuring of afkeuring mag laten horen. Maar dit is een bijzondere procedure, dus ik sta dit toe. Ik vind het heel erg mooi om aangesproken te worden. En de heer Bruins van de ChristenUnie, ook een christelijke partij.
Well, thank you very much for giving this very eloquent speech. And thank you, Lilian Marijnis, for making this happen. So I like your book and I think it's important, especially at this time, to discuss it. But if we want to change this, I think we need more than just considering ourselves change agents. We need to look at what would be effective mechanisms of changing this. And one of the root causes, I think, of this problem is how you make money. We should realize that it's a matter of luck, and therefore we need to redistribute. So I would like to hear your opinion on that. And second, and maybe that's a point where I feel slightly different from our esteemed colleagues from the Socialist Party, I think we also need internationalism to tackle this. We need supranational bodies to be effective in forcing countries to tax, including our own country. So we need OECD standards. We need the European Union to step up. We need international bodies to change this, because if we wait for American politics to change, we might wait a long time.
Thank you for that. So on the first point, one of the inspirations for my book was a sentence, single sentence, that I saw in Thomas Piketty's book, Capital, from several years ago. And writers often leave little breadcrumbs for other writers of the things they don't want to take on, but they hope someone else takes on. So he's not a culture person. He's a sociology person. He's an economist. And the breadcrumb he left, he said, you know, whether or not this level of extreme inequality that we're all talking about is sustainable depends not just on the repressive apparatus, he called it, but also on the effectiveness of the apparatus of justification. And I read that sentence and I thought, my book is about the apparatus of justification. So you're right about the limousine liberals, the culture. How does Mark Zuckerberg, like, how is it possible that you can allow cyber war to be conducted on a country through your for-profit company because you don't want to be regulated and you don't want the government looking in? Right? But the kid with the small Ziploc bag of weed in jail. So the answer that I would have for that is culture. We all believe something, some more than others, about Mark Zuckerberg, or at least we did a few years ago, that allowed him that impunity. We believed, sort of, that he was changing the world. We believed that he was building community. We believed he wasn't in it for the money or power. And it's our belief, and that's why I hope this is an empowering book, not a depressing book. We all believe things that give a very small number of people impunity to rule us. So I think culture and telling different stories about government, etc., is an incredibly powerful tool. On your international cooperation and taxation, you couldn't be more right. And I'll give you a specific example that's domestic within the US, but you could imagine the same thing for the world. Amazon, as you might know, recently had this bidding war to locate a second headquarters, right? And it forced, I think, 300 or something municipalities, states, different areas in the US to bid and compete. They all had to hand over tremendous amounts of private data that was very valuable data to Amazon, and it forced this race to the bottom. Every jurisdiction was promising lower taxes, more tax benefits, giving everything away just to get one more company. Even New York did it. New York does not have a shortage of people or companies. And you have all these places in America sabotaging each other, downbidding each other to give money to the world's richest man. Right? And we are doing the same thing among countries. I talked to you about your tax shelters here, but I'm sure we do the same to you in a different way. And we're all doing this and we're all doing this to each other. And I agree with you. Again, we need laws, we need treaties, we need things at the level of the international community to resolve that.
Met jouw welnemen, meneer Nijboer, ga ik naar de heer Van der Lee van GroenLinks.
Thanks very much. Thanks for the presentation, for a great book. I think we're all familiar with the term greenwashing, plutocrats trying to be, put on a social face. If you look at the Frightening Five, if you look at Bezos, Zuckerberg, Gates, they are a product of government policies, of the entrepreneurial state. And my question to you is, what kind of forms of hope, of countervailing power, do you see in the states?
It's a great question, and I think you have to understand, you know, when a fraudulent idea captures a society, becomes a consensus, even if it's fraudulent, it must have something powerful going for it. And I think America was gripped by a kind of neoliberal intellectual cult over the last generation that was actively pushed on the right, but was passively breathed in like secondhand smoke on the left. So that Ronald Reagan said, you know, government is the problem, but Bill Clinton said the era of big government is over, right? They're part of the same intellectual framework. And the seduction of this idea, before we say what's wrong with it, the seduction of this idea is immense. The idea that you can fight for the least among us, you can be on the barricades, you can help the poor, you can care about Africa, you can care about the poorest regions of your own country, and nothing has to change for anybody on the top. This is a beautiful dream. I understand the seduction of this dream, right? And I think if they told the men in this room, all of us, we have found a new way to empower women after thousands of years of patriarchy, and it involves nothing changing for any of you men, and none of you men having to change, I think we would all click, right? The problem is it's a lie. And the neoliberal fantasy in America that I have tried to report on tells the richest and most powerful people, we have found a clever new tool or set of tools to do what everyone from Karl Marx to Dr. Martin Luther King dreamed of doing, but we found a new way to do it that you don't even have to know it's happening. It'll happen beneath your feet, invisible to you, it costs you nothing. And so that has been the fantasy, it has been the seduction, and what is exciting in America is that I think the cult is coming to an end. In a way, Donald Trump, although it's not clear that he can read, was not necessarily a neoliberal candidate. He has certainly become a neoliberal in office, basically handing over the reins to rich people. But he ran against financial capitalism, not caring about local communities. And that was important. And he said something that no one in his party was willing to say. And by the way, next time, smarter, more thoughtful people in his party down the road may actually want to pick up on what was true about that. Because it is true, that part. And now in the Democratic Party, you had Senator Sanders last time. Now you have two. Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are avowedly not part of the neoliberal consensus. But interestingly, and this is how you tell a culture is changing, Mayor Pete Buttigieg is in the top four. He said the other day, he's a centrist. He is not at all where Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are. However, he said a few days ago, the era of neoliberalism has to end, right? When someone like him is saying that, you can tell a new consensus is close. That feels exciting to me. And in terms of the how do you build countervailing power, the old answer is the new answer. It's people power, and I think we've forgotten it. There's a wonderful writer in America. You should have her next as part of your American Writer Fellowship program called Gia Tolentino. She is, I think, about 30 years old. She already is one of the great writers of her generation. Brilliant. She's written a book called Trick Mirror. And one of the things she talks about is how the internet and Twitter and Instagram and all these things create a sensation of being civically active when in fact we are not. Create a sensation of being in movements when we're actually not. You know, the people in the American Civil Rights Movement, they knew each other actually, offline. There was no online. They bailed each other out of jail. They sat and waited together. They went places together. Today, you click on something, you retweet something, then you go back to watching the Kardashians and you feel like you are so civically involved. And I would say, as someone who lives in a country where I am watching the rule of law erode in my country, it is amazing that not one day in the last 2.5 years have I been unable to get to a meeting because the roads are closed, because we got tractors in the streets the way you do. Not one day. It is actually appalling to me that there's not been one general strike. Do you see if it's so I think we need to reclaim the heritage of joining, not clicking.
So thank you very much for your inspiring words. I'm a representative of a party called Party for the Animals, which may sound a bit strange to you when you hear it for the first time. But my questions are related to, in fact, the name of our parties. And could you reflect on the fact that what you described, in fact, is the pinnacle of a culture that is egocentric, whereas we should strive more for an eco-centric society. And the second question is related to that. I've been known to label banks and fossil industry as weapons of mass destruction for a reason. It's also to illustrate that we need laws on international level that make the destruction of ecosystems punishable by law. It's called ecocide. It's supposed to be in the Statute of Rome. It's one of the five crimes against humanity to counterbalance the horrible power that is now currently not counterbalanced of these types of corporations who are destroying the earth. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I think what you're raising is a very profound question that I think doesn't get talked about enough, because there is a connection, there's a line connecting so many of these seemingly disparate problems, which is even deeper than capitalism or money or the state, but I think has to do with a certain view of ourselves. And you call it egoism egocentric view to an ecocentric view. I think that's right, and I would flip that around also by saying, I think one of the failures thus far of the environmental movement, the people who want to make progress on this issue, is I don't think we have created an exciting and seductive enough replacement culture if we're going to take away a culture and set of values that people are attached to, even if they know it's wrong. And from the egocentric to the ecocentric is really a different way of life. Right? So in America, for example, and it's very different from here, but the car means something to people. Now, I live in New York City. I have a car. I don't care about my car. I don't love my car, but I'm not typical in that way, right? I have subways. I have many things. But in many parts of America, you can't understand in a narrow way what cars mean to people. It's freedom. It's no one telling you what to do. It's the radio. It's a space where your kids are not bothering you on the way to work, whatever. And we now want to tell people, as people pushing the Green New Deal are, like, that's not the way. You're going to have light rail. And that's correct. I'm for that vision. But I think we have not understood that psychologically we're asking people to change. And we're asking people to give up things that are valuable to them. And I think there just hasn't been enough cultural work making the new world exciting.
Just the observation on the ecocide law.
I'd have to look at the specifics of it, but the idea of it sounds... I would even broaden it one step beyond that, which is, right now, we treat companies more or less the same if they have a way of doing business that is positive for society, that makes things better, that provides people a useful service at a reasonable price, and a company whose literal existence is dependent on destroying the planet or people, we treat them the same. They pay the same tax rate right now. Their owners pay the same wealth taxes. They are subject to the same corporate law, right? Why do we do that? And so, whether you call it ecocide or something else, I just don't think it should be legal anymore to make money by making things worse. And that should be an obvious statement. I think of all the things we've talked about today, I could probably explain that to my four-year-old more easily than anything else. And I think he would be surprised to learn that right now, in most of our societies, it is completely legal, if not encouraged, to make money by making things worse. And I think we have to get to a place where we have the courage to say, we only have one world, we only have one planet, we have a limited time on it, potentially, as individuals and maybe even all of us as a species. And it's time to insist, as a privilege of operating businesses in these societies, that you honor humanity and animals.
That was Anand Giridharadas, editor-at-large for Time magazine, political analyst for MSNBC, and a visiting scholar at the Journalism Institute at New York University. He had been invited by the Dutch Parliament to discuss his book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. When Giridharadas came home to New York in October 2019, he expressed his amazement and delight that any contemporary parliament would even invite a writer for a discussion and show themselves well-informed, willing to test their own thinking, share policy doubts, and ask for advice. You can find the video of the full session on YouTube under Why the Super Rich Won't Change the World. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.